It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots of security news. We will cover that. And then Steve's going to run through the privacy settings on Windows 10, tell you what they all mean and why he will never use it. That's coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 519, recorded Tuesday, August 4th, 2015, the Windows 10 privacy trade-off. Security Now is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code SECURITYNOW when you check out. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, you get every way to pay. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you. And boy, there's never been a more important time for Security Now than right now. Steve Gibson is here. He is our security guru at grc.com. And I could go through his credentials. He just was first person to discover spyware, right? The first anti-spyware tool. He's had his own lovely battles against DDoSing and others. And for the last 10 years...
Yeah.
It's going to be 10 years. It's going to be 11. We start our 11th year in a little bit.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so this is episode 519. Of course, we've been very good about never missing a year or never missing a week. I think we did once. So, obviously at episode 520, that would be 10 times 52 weeks a year. So we're definitely in the vicinity now. This was supposed to be a Q&A, only in as much as we haven't had one for a couple of weeks. But the press went so bonkers over the spying, for to use the generic term, that is the default set of settings in Windows 10, that I thought, okay, let's take a look at this. Windows 10 released the day after last week's podcast on Wednesday. And so I titled this the Win 10 Privacy Trade-Off, because, this podcast, we focus a lot on security and its close cousin, privacy. And I have a very sort of a much more relaxed take on this. I've studied what Windows 10 does. The good news is no one will ever make me use it, which is fine.
But you mean you'll never use Windows 10?
Oh, I hope I never do. The good news is that Windows 7 is supported through 2020, all the way through this next president's first term. So I figure, by 2020, maybe there'll be an alternative. Maybe at that point, maybe it'll be time for me to switch over to Linux or over to Mac. But Windows 10 has nothing for me. But we'll talk about that.
Wow.
So that's sort of my introduction to.
So you're not going to use Windows 10 until President Trump retires?
Or gets reelected for a second term.
Okay.
Assuming that impeachment is off the table.
So, that's interesting. I've gone both ways on this one, and what I'm really curious is what capabilities we can determine that Microsoft has to spy on us. The truth is, if you're using the cloud, even with Windows 3.11, you're using the cloud.
Yeah. So I really view this as a trade-off, and this is something that our listeners are. Really, I mean, there's no better audience to discuss this with, because there are people who are installing TrueCrypt on their drives, knowing that it's no longer supported, but that as far as we know from its examinations and audits, it's secure, but they would not use the built-in BitLocker that is it BitLocker?
Yeah.
BitLocker. Yeah. That Windows makes even easier to use. They're not going to do that because they just don't trust a system that's built in. And similarly, they don't want to use IE, which comes with Windows. They want to take responsibility and use Firefox or Chrome, depending. So my take, and we'll get to this in a second, but is that this is the Windows 10 shows a new philosophy. I mean, and it's more of a catch up than anything else. It's Microsoft catching up to sort of the iOS model with, you know, ads in apps and sort of curated, you know, there's now a Windows Store. And also the sort of the Google model of everything is cloud and the browser is your viewer. So anyway, we'll get into that. Right now, Black Hat and DEF CON are underway, and there are, you know, we've already talked about a couple of the stories that are being fully illuminated during the conference. The Jeep hacking with Chrysler and the stage fright breach, the MMS problem. I want to talk about that a little bit. There's some more news about that from Android. So I imagine next week and the week after and you know, in forthcoming weeks, I've scanned through the program and there are some other really interesting looking things where we just don't have enough information yet. You know, these, the Jeep hacking and the stage fright issues sort of escaped and got strong press coverage, and so, you know, and we had enough information about them that we were able to talk about them. We're going to have to wait until the most of these presentations have been given, and then we'll be able to choose the goodies. So I think we'll have no problem finding some really interesting new things to talk about.
You're going to come podcast. On the new screensavers on Saturday, yes, and on give Saturday. Us an update. So that'll be, yep, something to tune in for. Yeah.
Exactly. We will just be post-conference at that point. So I want to talk about some news about stage fright. There's a worrisome DOS vulnerability affecting the internet's DNS server, Bind. One of our sponsors, PagerDuty, suffered a database breach. OS X has a somewhat worrisome zero day in the wild, but being a privilege elevation bug as opposed to a remote execution, it's again, I would sort of tamp down the hysteria on this one a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about NoScript versus Sandboxy, because I'm experimenting with Sandboxy now. And I'll explain why, and some miscellaneous stuff, and then some discussion about Windows 10. So I think a fun podcast.
Good. And I see you're clean shave. Are you? No, wait a minute. You didn't shave today. Maybe I better.
No. I am absolutely smooth as a baby's you know what.
A good thing, because
it's like, it's strange too. It's just like, so
you're not,
like,
used to it.
I'm not.
Yeah, you like shaving though, because
I shave for you, Leo.
You shave for me because of Harry's, our fine.
That's right.
Our fine
sponsor.
Orange
handle. Yeah. I love the orange handle.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I use the Harry's Winston kit. So what is Harry's? Harry's is a better way to shave. Great razor blades, half price from the drugstore, expensive, overpriced drugstore blades, plus the best shaving cream or shaving, actually this is the foaming shave gel, but I use the shave cream, and it's delivered by subscription to your door at no cost. And so, all told, this is a really, really good thing to know about for anybody who shaves. HARRYS.com. Oh, yeah, I have the, this is the Truman. At home, I have the Winston. So Winston's $25 kit. The Truman is a $15 kit, and I'll tell you how you can save a little bit off that in a second. Steve likes the Truman because he likes the handle, which has flat, one side's flat, so he always knows the orientation. Plus, unlike the Winston, the handle isn't cold in the morning. I do warm up the Winston.
It seems a little grippier. It just, you know, the plastic has a, it just seems a little stickier to
Well,
me,
it also has a virtue of being less expensive. So, Steve, you're a frugal fella. Actually, this is a great deal. So, $15 for the Truman kit. You get the handle, of course. You get the blade, not just one, but you get three blades total. So, we're talking a 3-week supply. You also get not to be diminished, the cover, which I use when I travel because I'm going to put my razor in my dop kit and I don't want to accidentally cut my finger. This is great. It's got a little ventilation port. It lets it dry out, but it's a safety cover, which is really nice. And then you get a full size, not a little trial sample, but a full size of the foaming shave gel, which smells incredible, but also really, really smooths the way. So when you get a great razor blade, super sharp, super well designed, and the foaming shave gel or the shave cream, you're getting a better shave than you've ever had before for half the cost. Now, why are these blades so good? Because Harry's bought the factory. When they started up, they did a little research, and they found out that the best razor blades are made by a factory in Germany. I love this new era, so they bought it. So now they can tell the factory, you know, how to design the blades for performance, for sharpness, and then ship direct to you, saving a lot of money. Direct to you from Harry's.com and their factory. So I'm going to put this all away. The Harry's kit, and then you get the Truman or the Winston. You could save $5 right now off your first order if you use our offer code SECURITYNOW. They also sell some other cool things like this razor handle. I've got mine engraved with my name, Leo. It's a nice solid aluminum cube, beautifully designed. You'd love to have that in your bathroom. I just love Harry's. Go to HARRYS.com and use the offer code SECURITYNOW on checkout. You'll save $5. That means this Truman kit is 10 bucks. Get one for your dad, for your grad, for your son, for your daughter. Get one for the whole family. Harry's.com. Security Now, the offer code to save $5 off.
How about for your college freshman as he's heading out the door off to, for his first college experience?
You bet. You bet. What a nice gift.
So, okay. We need to talk about stage fright because at this point, as of this morning when I looked, there is no indication that anyone has patched it. And in fact, some particularly clueless providers have said, well, there, you know, it's not being exploited, so, you know, we're still looking at it. Well, the fact is, it is in the wild. It is the exploits for stage fright have appeared in some vulnerability, I mean, some exploit kits. So we need to talk a little bit about mitigations. What can we do in order to, until we get this thing fixed, what's the solution? And that's one thing we didn't discuss last week. And the good news is it's not super difficult. So just to recap a bit, the problem is with some sort of pre-parsing that occurs whenever an Android phone, and that's from Android 2.2 on, receives a multimedia message, an MMS text message, or media message. There are like six different problems that were discovered by someone looking at the code who is giving a demo right now as we speak at the Black Hat conference about how to do this. They have stated they will release proof of concept code after the conference. So that's really what I'm excited for, because I think that's really what we need in order to get this thing, in order for people to understand what's happening. So the idea is that your phone receives a deliberately, specially maliciously crafted MMS message, and that allows the sender to execute their own payload with strong privileges. I think it's system level privileges, which is one step shy of root level. Basically, it can do everything it wants to on the Android device. So I'm definitely on the lookout for the proof of concept code. I almost plowed into these the exploit kits to dig around, but I'm sure we're going to get this next week. And this is a big enough problem that there's no reason for me to do this redundantly. I imagine the industry will be responding, but somehow
I hope they do. I mean, it's
yes. Yeah. Okay. So essentially the problem is that the default settings, both for Hangout and for Messages, on Android are auto retrieve. And so without you doing anything, your phone is retrieving and parsing MMS messages. Essentially, what you need to consider is that MMS messages from someone you don't know and trust should be viewed with some caution. But you can't have your phone open them and process them automatically. So essentially, you simply need to, first of all, I mean, number one rule is make sure you're running the latest firmware, that your phone is current and up to date. Because if this gets fixed, you're going to need an over-the-air update in order to have this patched, assuming that your provider starts doing that. And again, this to me seems like a huge opportunity for hackers. They noticed that prior to the disclosure, the exploit kits already had this, meaning that all that was necessary was for there to be any indication that there was even a problem here, and immediately this got exploited. And as we said, it's just shy of half of 1 billion total phones. On the order of 950 million phones are believed to be vulnerable. So, this is a big carrot dangling in front of the bad guys. Anyway, so bottom line, make sure you're keeping yourself updated. Then you want to disable the auto fetching, both for Hangout and for Messages. And I'm sure that our listeners know how to do that. For Hangout, you go into Options, Setting, SMS, Advanced, and then you will see Auto Retrieve MMS. Just turn that off. And then under Messages, it's under More, and then Settings, and then I like this, More Settings. And then you'll see Multimedia Messages, and that there it says Disable Auto Retrieve. And so just turn those off. Now, what that means is that your phone will no longer, obviously, automatically be putting these down and parsing them. But that's the only mitigation we have for the moment. And, we'll keep an eye on this. We'll let everyone know if there's suddenly been this, like a raft of exploitation, which ramps this up. At this point, there have been vulnerabilities found in the wild. So we absolutely know that it is being exploited, probably at this point in limited targeted attacks. We would sort of expect that. I mean, the one thing you need is somebody's phone number in order to send them one of these. On the other hand, the phones tend to be allocated in blocks of phone numbers, and so in the same way that the Jeep was all of these various Chryslers could be scanned because they knew what IP range they were in, so could like MMS messages be spewed to a bunch of phone numbers that are known to be offered by a vulnerable carrier. So anyway, to me, this is still very much at the front of our radar, and for listeners who want to take the appropriate measure, just telling your phone, don't pick up my MMS messages by default is the way to do that.
CyanogenMod has fixed that in the most recent versions of CyanogenMod. Has Google fixed it? Do you know in 5.1.1?
Yes, they instantly patched theirs.
So if you're using an up-to-date Google phone, a Nexus phone, you're all right.
Right. And it's probably as we know, the problem is that carriers tend to abandon their older phones. Yeah. Yet these older phones are going to be vulnerable. So I think I don't want anything bad to come of this, but we really do need something to get carriers to belly up to the bar and take some more responsibility. I know that there's some legislation that Congress has been talking about as a consequence of these problems to motivate carriers to do more, to take responsibility for the older property which they have sold. I mean, these are connected computers, and we know that we're finding that they have the same kind kind of security problems that all of our connected computers have always had. Unfortunately, you know, despite everyone's best efforts, we keep having code that's a little bit more porous than we wish it were.
I do wish there was some place you could go to see if your phone is has been updated.
That's what we need. That's someone will do it. And as I said last week, make sure that I find out about it through Twitter as soon as the service exists. If I weren't in the middle of Squirrel or Spinrite, I would just drop everything and do it. Because although I was thinking about it too, it's a little tricky because you don't want to create a service that will be certainly nothing that anyone would do would be malicious. They'd be delivering a benign demo payload, but you don't want to allow that service to be abused just to like harass people. So I guess you'd need to do something like your phone. You'd need to send a text message from your phone to this particular service so that it got your phone number, and then it would echo back, or maybe like, you know, prompt you to, you know, hit yes if you want to receive a test message, and then it would send it to you. That's, you know, it would be, doing it right would be a little more involved, but that's what we need. We need mostly to like spread the word and to get people to put pressure on their carriers. We need a demo of it. We need some way for this thing to you know, the equivalent of how, you know, on Windows, when you have a flash exploit, you know, they make the calculator app pop up on your desk, which Flash should absolutely never be able to do. It's like, whoa, there's the calculator. Now that could have been, you know, anything we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
But you know, so it drives the point home.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll I'm excited when we get a proof of concept. Maybe these guys will do this themselves. You know, their corporate mobile phone security. They generated a huge amount of attention for themselves. I've been keeping an eye on their website, and I mean, this has been good for them, and I think they deserve it because they brought a potentially bad problem to light. It'd be great if they were able to bring up a demo to you know that anyone could use to verify that. Whoa, look at that! That shouldn't have happened. I need to get this fixed. Okay, so. Also in the news has been a new problem with DNS. We haven't had any problems with DNS, boy, you know, for years. Of course, I did a GRC has a spoofability page, which I created after Dan Kaminsky demonstrated that the port numbers that were being allocated by DNS servers were sequential, and that created a huge vulnerability for spoofing DNS. And so, you know, I created a system for GRC that allows people to check the DNS servers they're using, the DNS servers that are resolving their own IPs for them, for the quality of the way they're working to see how spoofable their DNS server is. We've got a new problem though. And what's interesting about this is that the people who have dug into this equate this in some ways to open SSL. The internet's primary sort of granddaddy DNS server is bind, and it's called bind because what it does is it binds a domain name to an IP address. That's what it does. It creates the binding between something, you know, www.amazon.com and whatever Amazon's IP list is. The problem is that exactly like OpenSSL, everything that anyone has ever thought to do with DNS, they implement in bind. It's like the armature on which you hang all of your DNS experiments. In the same way that OpenSSL is the armature on which you hang all of your experiments about secure point-to-point TCP connections. And as a consequence, for example, this is why, whereas OpenSSL has hundreds of thousands of lines of code, Amazon has written, and this is something that we covered while you were away, Leo, Amazon has written their own little TLS implementation in 7,000 lines lines of code, which they're using on their AWS services. And they note that the reason that this massive many hundreds of thousands of line disparity is it OpenSSL? It's the, you know, it's the Swiss Army knife for, I mean, it's got certificate stuff and communication stuff, and every little experimental feature that anyone ever wanted to implement is there. The same is the case with Bind. And what happened is, what was discovered was that there's something known as a transaction key record, which is part of the protocol for Bind servers to talk to each other for establishing secure keying between servers. And the discoverer revealed it responsibly, meaning that the problem was found and it was fixed and offered and made available in Bind before it was disclosed. So we couldn't ask for anything better than that, except that there's an awful lot of DNS servers on the internet, and not everybody is keeping them up to date. And so anyone can update their version of Bind, and what they get is then somebody is unable to simply send their server, which is by definition publicly available. That's what DNS is for. It's a public DNS server. Send it a deliberately malformed packet and crash it. And so that's what this does. This crashes DNS servers. There's been no mention of this thing going any further into some sort of a deeper exploit. And it already is patched, as I said. The problem is that servers are now being crashed all over the internet. The news of how to do this has gotten loose, and anyone who has a publicly exposed, and I mean there are internal DNS servers. In fact, GRC runs one. My DNS server, and I'm running Bind, it's the slave for the two big iron level 3 servers. And mine is not available to the internet. Mine, there's no visibility to GRC's DNS. Instead, I use level 3s as slaves to mine. And that is a perfect example of the fact that publicly exposed DNS servers don't need to have all these features. What the old school DNS and internet gurus have said of this vulnerability is the problem is Bind has gotten old and huge. It is the kitchen sink for DNS. It, like I said, it's the standard repository for all experiments, and it's carrying them all. But the fact is, a really scaled down, minimal feature DNS server could easily do 99.99% of what a DNS server has to do, be much smaller, be much faster, and not start exposing these sorts of problems which arise from the things age and just, you know, crazy feature set. So one of the things I think sort of generically that we're seeing, stepping back from this particular instance, is these original tools like Bind, like OpenSSL, they're beginning to sort of collapse under their own weight. They're getting old. The code is old. They have been the common central store for the each of their own set of functionality. But what we're beginning to see is replacements, you know, scaled down, leaner, meaner, faster rewrites that re-implement the same functionality, but are, because they're small, make them far more auditable. You know, you can't audit OpenSSLs, you know, 500 or I forgot what the number was now, but it was hundreds of thousands of lines of code. Only a smaller portion was had to do with TLS, despite the fact that it's, you know, it's pulling this whole library around all the time, regardless. So anyway, so it's sort of interesting to see that this is what's going on with the internet, is these really original big platforms are starting to have problems, and people are saying, you know, it's just not such a big deal to recreate some of this core technology and bring it current and use more modern languages that perhaps give us more control over vulnerabilities, and also take this opportunity to only retain the features that we need to. Okay. Also in the news, PagerDuty suffered a breach. And from what they said, it looked to me like they did. I mean, their architecture was as good as any we could ask for. The company acknowledged that that they saw evidence that an attacker gained unauthorized access, they said, to our users' names, email addresses, public calendar feed URLs, and hashed, salted, and peppered passwords. And I, in fact, in my show notes, I titled it.
They said peppered?
Yes.
They have a good sense of humor, I have to say.
Well, I said, PagerDuty not only salts their passwords, they pepper them too. And so then that was the title of this topic in the show notes. And I said, how do we know? And so they wrote, based on the investigation, the attacker bypassed multiple layers of authentication and gained unauthorized access to an administrative panel provided by one of our infrastructure partners. With this access, they were able to log into a replica of one of PagerDuty's databases. The evidence indicates that the attacker gained access to users' names, email addresses, hashed passwords, and public calendar feed URLs. And then they said users who do not, and they sent out email to everyone announcing that they had suffered this problem and instructing people, erring in favor of caution, change your password, which is, you know, the standard security wisdom. We went through this when LastPass had what, you know, that they saw suspicious traffic on their network and said, whoa, this looks wrong. We're going to err in favor of caution. Everybody should change your password.
So this is similar to the LastPass situation where.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where they have no in the wild, no zero day, no reason to believe anybody has done anything, but they found evidence that somebody got in and accessed this database. Okay. So they said users who do not reset their password by Monday, August 3rd, that's yesterday, at 12 p.m. Pacific time, will be automatically logged out of the website and will receive an email prompting them to reset their password.
Good. That's
so
the right way
so they're going that. A step further and saying, look, we're kicking you off. You need to do this. However, I got a kick out of this. They said, we use robust hashing techniques to protect passwords. If you have logged into your account any time this year, your password is hashed with Bcrypt, and that's one of the industry standard strong PBKDF2s, password-based key derivation functions, which deliberately thwarts all of the fast hash attacks, with a work factor of 10, using a per-user randomly generated salt and a site-wide pepper. Thus, the term pepper.
Well, this is not a joke. There is this real thing called pepper.
Yeah, it is. Yes, and so they said older passwords were hashed with SHA-1 over multiple rounds and using the same salt and pepper approach. So what they did was they were always doing multiple iterations. Previously, they were using an iterated SHA-1 hash, but still using per user salt and per enterprise or per site pepper. And the point is that the pepper is a secret. The idea being that if you got the database, the salt prevents you from doing a mass reverse engineering of like all of their databases hashes by making it a per user salt. The pepper is not stored with the database. So it's an additional secret which really rules out anyone's ability to do anything unless they're able to obtain the pepper. And they said both the salt and pepper are 40 characters long and randomly generated. So, you know, this gives us, although they didn't want to give us in this fashion, a sneak peek into the way they're protecting their users' data.
Sounds pretty good.
They're state of the art. Yeah. You couldn't ask for anything better. Yeah. And they've, you know, notified everybody and are forcing a password change.
You could ask for one thing better, not to get hacked in the first place.
Yes, exactly.
Minor thing.
Yeah. And in fact, when I was thinking about the whole Win 10 thing, I was thinking, you know, Microsoft is never in the news with, you know, major breaches of their network. So, you know, and in fact, you know, the big guys typically aren't. The really big guys, you know, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, people are upset. There are people who are upset that, you know, there's all this cloud aggregation and cross-platform synchronization and blah, 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 and we have to trust them and all that. But it's at the same time, they're proving themselves responsible, keepers of this, of this material.
So and you have to figure that Microsoft's under attack constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be the crown jewels.
Yeah. And in fact, it's almost better to have a long standing history of that, because it gives you an opportunity to tune up your defenses and have them, you know, being tested all the time.
Right.
So also in the news, there was a zero-day bug, which has been found. We I don't know if I talked about it last week. Maybe I didn't, because the news was it had not yet been exploited and it had already been patched in the forthcoming beta. And I think it sort of slipped under my radar because we already had plenty to talk about. But now we've moved into it being a zero day, meaning that it has been found in the wild. What this is, though, this is not a user does nothing remote execution. This is a password bypass. So that's the nature of the privilege escalation, is that a way has been found for bad software that does get loose on a Mac, and that is 10.10.4 and the beta of 10.10.5. Both are vulnerable. If software does manage to get onto your machine, it doesn't need it. It's bypassing the standard, you know, we must have your password to install this isolation. And so that it's able to get past. On the other hand, what has been found is that, you know, as we know, this would be part of a chain of exploitation that might begin with a browser exploit, and then this would get called into play in order to get this thing into your system without having to perform some social engineering of some sort in order to get you to believe that you're installing something that you're not, for example. Because this is a zero day, and 10.10.5 is vulnerable, there's some expectation that Apple may patch this in the beta of 10.10.5 rather than waiting for 10.11, which is in beta also and has this fixed. So this indicates that it was fixed, like when the news first appeared, it was already fixed.
Yeah.
So Apple knew about this but was probably saying, well, you know, it's not a horrible problem and there's no evidence that that's being exploited, so we could wait.
Apple knew about it because it had been revealed to them. And so what happened with this is this researcher revealed it to the public, a different researcher than the one who discovered it.
Ah, okay, good.
So he said, I'm not going to wait anymore.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Thumbing their nose at proper disclosure.
It's convenient. Black hat's going on, you know.
Yeah. Get a little okay, bit of attention. So I have to say that I'm experimenting with abandoning NoScript.
Gasp. I know you're waiting for me to gasp. Gasp. Say it ain't so, Steve.
I was waiting for that, yes.
Why?
Well,
why,
because I've made so much fuss and stink about scripting over. I mean, that's my number one mantra. Yeah,
and
is,
I have always said,
God,
I'll get over it, but go ahead.
Well, what I think has happened, I've been using NoScript for years, and I preach it, and, you know, Giorgio and I talk from time to time. There's something that the NoScript does, which a squirrel just tripped over a couple weeks ago. And so Giorgio and I were able to exchange email, and he showed me how to, you know, allow NoScript to allow this thing that the squirrel client was starting to need it to do. And so, you know, and he listens to the podcast, and so he knows that I'm a fan of NoScript. The problem is, there has been, I mean, this is the only way I can explain it, is I've recently been covering the last few weeks our own listeners who have been coming back to us and me saying, gosh, Steve, you know, this is really a pain. And what I have found is it is really a pain, but it wasn't a pain a year ago. It wasn't a pain a year ago.
I am shocked. Shocked.
For example, I'm seeing unique gibberish dot cloudfront.com. So like CloudFront is now a big CDN providing content. Lots of sites are using it, and it's providing a random looking DNS for themselves. I'm sure they've got some fancy DNS that is resolving that into a particular IP for that customer. Who knows? But what's happened is there has been, I've been talking about this explosion of scripting. And the problem is, it's just incredibly annoying to have to go through multiple iterations of allowing scripts to run. So I'll enable the main page, and in the main page's JavaScript, that's now invoking 20 more different domains. And so it's like, oh. And so it's like, okay, which ones do I have to turn on in order to get this page to go? And, you know, and my point is, there has been an explosion, unfortunately, in the last year in scripting. And so I'm experimenting now with Sandboxy. I want Firefox to be wrapped in something, but it's just not practical. I'm sorry, Giorgio, but I'm gonna try going without NoScript. But I still would like some protection, some good extra belt and suspenders. And so I just wanted to mention to people. I contacted the Sandboxy people. My license my version had was no longer valid. And when I tried to use my old license, they said, "Oh, this only has 5 digits. You got to get a fancy, shiny new one." So anyway, I got that, and I'm in the process of sort of getting to know it. When I created my show notes for the podcast, I do that in Google Drive, and then I export it as a PDF. And I thought, oh, what's going to happen now? Because I've only been using it for a couple days, and so it showed me my normal PDF destination, which is outside the sandbox. And so when I said, yeah, I want to save this over here, and I got this wonderful little prompt that said, something is trying to be saved outside of Sandboxy. Do you want to allow this or not? And it's like, oh, this is a good thing. So I said, yes. And it went to its normal place. So anyway, we covered Sandboxy years ago. You could probably Google Security Now Sandboxy and find the podcast where I talked about it. We did a whole podcast on it because it is, as I mentioned when I talked about it recently in the last couple of weeks, Sandbox IE, as in Sandbox Internet Explorer, was where it started, and it has then blossomed. And installation was easy. It knew that Firefox was my default browser. It put it in its sandbox all by itself and just started working. So anyway, I will report after a few more weeks on how I'm doing with it. But I did want to just acknowledge to people who may have been suffering the same script blocking fatigue that I have been. It's just, unfortunately, what you know, the tool that I have used for years and liked is just becoming too big a problem. The, not only is there just too much scripting, but sites have become utterly dependent upon it. Many sites used to, you know, used to work with scripting disabled.
We almost universally, the people who had the most problems with our new Twit page were people who were using, who were listeners to this show using no script. And you know,
sorry,
I don't know what to say. You know, the site's not going to work if you block JavaScript. Admittedly, there's a problem.
I mean, not alone.
Oh, everybody uses it, and admittedly, there's a problem because a lot of sites load JavaScript from third-party sites. That's very common, and not only is that slow and big and bloated, but it's risky. I understand. The truth is part of the problem. I just watched a great, in fact, I should give you a link to this, a great presentation from Alan Kay, one of the premier computer scientists in the world.
Alan and I are good friends.
You know Alan Kay?
Absolutely.
He's my personal hero. I have never seen a talk by him at which I wasn't deeply inspired.
He is one of the true geniuses of the early PC era.
And an Apple fellow today, and one of the guys who worked at Xerox PARC and was, you know, I don't know, but I imagine present at the demo to end all demos and all of that.
He was head of Atari's research. And in fact, he discovered the light pen, and introduced
that's me. How you know him.
He introduced me to the Atari people because he said, okay, we have to have this.
So he said something. This is a great talk. It's he gave it to the University of Illinois at Urbana, the National Supercomputer Applications Center there, which wrote Mozilla, which wrote the, you know, I mean, that's where Mark Andreessen was when he wrote Mozilla. Are you frozen on me? I think he is. He has faded away. Well, I'll continue to talk while we get him back. One of the things he said is we have not made forward progress. We've made backward progress with web browsers. He said, and he challenged the grad students there to rethink, this is in 2009, the browser. He said, if you were going to design the, what's happened, of course, is people have just built on what was done. He said Mozilla was a terrible idea to begin with. It's a shame that Tim Berners-Lee hadn't seen the work that Doug Engelbart and others at PARC had done 20 years earlier when he invented the World Wide Web. He reinvented the wheel and didn't do a good job of it. But he said, if you wanted to rethink the browser, there we go. Steve's back. You hear me now?
Yeah.
This is the important part. If you wanted to rethink the browser, how would you do it? Clean slate. And the students thought about it, and I think they kind of came up with the idea. He said, you'd write it like an operating system kernel. What you don't want to do is extend the local browser with all these plugins and codecs and all this crap. That's just a broken system, and that's what we do right now. But at the same time, you want to design a browser that is able to handle all sorts of new, unpredicted stuff. And then there's this security issue, which is, of course, you've got to find a way to isolate the code that's running over there from your system. But he says you can do this. This is well known. This is called kernel, writing a kernel. The browser should be, in effect, an operating system kernel, which allows additional processes to be run remotely or locally, but totally sandboxed for security.
And that's Google, and that's the Chrome model.
So the guys who did this, Google bought. There was he quotes a brilliant graduate student, I can't remember where he was, who wrote a paper that describes exactly this. Google hired him. He had a startup. They bought the startup. And I think it's exactly the point of Chrome OS is how can we build, let's rethink the browser and let's build it so that it's secure. And that's why all those, each tab on the browser is sandboxed. And, you know, I don't know how effective it's been when you put it on a normal operating system, but certainly in Chrome OS, it's very effective, I think. It's very secure.
Right.
Yeah. And, and so that obviates the need for NoScript if you have well sandboxed processes running, right?
Yes, exactly. And you know, the expensive in several ways of doing this is a full VM to create a virtual machine with its own OS and that you use for browsing. You know, and you could even do a state save so that nothing is kept when you restart that VM. It reinitializes to the same state. What Sandboxy does is it hooks all of the applications means of communication. Windows apps have a at the end of the executable file is a series of jumps which are dynamically patched into to be the entry points to the DLLs, the dynamic link libraries that provide the OS functionality. And so, for example, I take advantage of that. I have code for GRC's net engine, my web server extension. I want to make sure that I don't have any memory leaks. So I have the net engine itself reaches down and hooks the essentially alloc and free and expands the allocations and puts guard bands at the beginning and ending so that I can tell if I overwrite or underwrite. Whenever I release the memory, it verifies the pattern in the guard bands. And it also it tracks all of my allocations so I can see whether I'm forgetting to free anything. Anyway, the point is that it's possible to hook existing functions for various purposes. Sandboxy reaches into whatever app you have put in the sandbox and hooks all of its communication, like file reading and writing, registry reading and writing, remote procedure calls, and the works. It hooks them all and essentially redirects them to a clone of the existing set of resources. So when the browser reads something, it allows that to go through and read it from the OS. But when it modifies something or writes something, that change or write is sandboxed. Essentially, it creates a copy of the original resource that doesn't allow the modification to actually be made globally. So what you're able to do is you're able to wash those changes away or selectively say, these things I want to then update globally. So it's sort of a poor man's, I don't mean to denigrate it. I mean it's a less expensive in terms of resources solution for protecting against, any kind of exploit.
If you can help me get Alan Kay on a triangulation, I'd be thrilled. And if you want to, folks, view this video, which I highly recommend, search, it's on YouTube. Just search for YouTube, Normal Considered Harmful. That's the title of his talk that he gave at
great talk.
University.
And how long ago was that?
2009.
Okay. I have a good friend who will no doubt have stayed in touch with him. I haven't talked to Alan for years, but we spent a lot of time together. So I'll see if I can track him down.
You want to be inspired. He gave talks that were like TED Talks before TED Talks. They're a little longer and a little less polished. But, boy, the ideas in them are incredible. And I always just feel like it was a kick in the head when I watch his talks.
He's one of the true pioneers of, like, deep computer science.
Yeah, really.
I mean, he's the father of small talk, which is, one of the first languages that, where everything is an object.
It's really good. Starts the talk. He's talking now. Remember, these are high-level graduate students at one of the best computer science schools in the world. And he starts the talk. He says, can you name these three scientists? And it's Newton, Darwin, and Einstein. Of course, everybody can. Then he shows five computer scientists. Some of the most important, the guys who've changed this business. And can you name any of them? And these are computer scientists. Nope.
Right.
None. Including Doug Engelbart. I think some people knew Doug Engelbart, but they thought that his key contribution was inventing the mouse. So it's good talk. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I watched it this morning, and I was so excited by it.
No kidding, just this morning.
Well, I don't know if you ever look at Hacker News. This is why Combinator's kind of /dot or dig. It's people submit stories and then vote them up or down. One of the things I like about it, I check it all the time, like more than once a day, is sometimes old stuff gets posted and surfaced. And this is obviously a 6-year-old talk, but then people look at it and they go, thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up. And it rises up to the top. And, it's a really good resource. If anybody wants to, kind of geek out, it's geek news. It's very geeky news. A lot of programming language stuff and so forth. It's, I think, let me just check real quickly. I think it's news. Yeah. News.ycombinator.com.
Yeah, actually, I think I have some links from them later on in the
Hacker News is it. It's
Hacker
it.
News. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did run across an interesting new podcast distribution system. The people somehow Security Now, I think, is being pitched to them. Anyway, it's podcall.io, which is an interesting concept. They're wanting to use a telephone. And so you would call a phone number and then I think you run through a little keypad switch, you know, it says, you know, press one for this podcast, press two for that podcast, and so forth. But the idea being that rather than subscribing to podcasts, or as an alternative, if you're away from whatever your podcast source is, you're able to they don't support very much. I think they're just getting themselves launched. But the people who told me about it said they're pushing to get Security Now picked up by these guys. So I don't know what that means, but I just thought I'd put it on everyone's radar.
The issue I have with it, this comes up every few years. We don't get counted. I don't care because so few people use it, it doesn't matter. But to do a service like this, they have to download the podcast, store it on their own network, and then serve it to the people.
So it counts as one download. So they would cover the ads, but it wouldn't be...
Well, I think the ads would get heard, but we wouldn't know how many people would use the service.
Ah, okay. Then in that case...
If it's convenient, do it.
Hear what I said.
If it's convenient, do it. That's fine. This comes up a lot.
I don't have any...
Go ahead.
I see. Sort of alternative podcast aggregators.
No, phone. People calling a number and listening to a podcast.
Oh, I've never heard it done.
Every couple of years, somebody writes me.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know why this... I guess if you didn't have any bandwidth. It seems like bandwidth is more plentiful than minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And I did get a nice note middle of last month from Jeff Lunt in Evanston, Illinois. He said, "Hey, Steve, huge fan of the Security Now podcast. Listeners since episode one, and then our standard blah, blah, blah." He said, I've been a fan of regularly backing up my data since my first major data loss at the age of 19. Now, I don't know how old he is today, so I don't know how long ago that was. But major data loss when he was 19. He says, "And while I've lost a drive or two in my time, I can't offer one of those really saved my bacon kinds of testimonials. Because since that first data loss, I've always had a backup for my truly important data. That said, I've also always been frustrated with disk utility tools built into OSs when something like SpinWrite is the only thing that really does the complete maintenance and recovery job. I recently bought a copy of SpinWrite to fix some of the drives in my media server and just wanted to drop you a line and say thanks for the awesome tool. While storage is cheap and it's easy to replace a dead drive," he says, parens assuming you have a good backup, "and go about your day. I just like the idea that I don't have to throw out a drive just because check disk in Windows or FSCK in Unix/Linux or disk utility on Mac can't do anything useful with it. SpinWrite is a great piece of work. And the stuff you're doing with Security Now, I think, qualifies you as a great human being on the whole. Keep up the great work." So, I think that qualifies you as a huge fan, Jeff. Thanks very much for the testimonial.
Awesome. That's great. By the way, they say on the front page of podcall.io, "Check out our newest podcast, Security Now."
Oh.
"And I will give you the phone number, 474, if you want to call it, 470-443-0900. The thing that makes me a little nervous, it says, "Try it free." I mean, I guess the implication is that it won't always be free, or maybe you'll get a free trial. And that actually would be a violation of our license if they charge people to listen to our
shows.
Can't
charge for it.
No, it's free, folks. You can get it for free. Call me. I'll read you the transcript from Elaine. Let's take a break, and then you're going to talk, and I am all ears on this one. You're going to talk about privacy concerns with Windows 10. And there's been a lot of FUD as well. You know, people parsing, I think incorrectly, the EULA, the End User License Agreement. But I'm dying to hear what you have to say about this. So that's coming up in just a second. First, though, a word from our sponsor, Braintree. We love our mobile developers. I know a lot of you have great apps in mind, or you're working on a team that's creating a great app. if you want mobile payments, and who doesn't, right, in your app, then you got to check out Braintree. As Steve has said many times, do not write your own system. Maybe Steve Gibson can write his own e-commerce system. You shouldn't. First of all, not only time-consuming, there's huge security issues. And, you know, the stats say that 70% of people who are buying something online abandon the shopping cart right there. 70%. And I think that that's for two reasons. One, it's too complicated, too hard. But most importantly, because they're afeared. They go, should I be giving my credit card to this page? Don't worry. Braintree does it for some of the biggest in the business. GitHub uses Braintree. In fact, they started with Braintree. Airbnb uses Braintree. Uber uses Braintree. Lyft does too. That tells you something. First of all, competitors both use the same system. And what is the secret sauce to Uber? And if you ask me, it's when you're done with the ride, the payment's handled. That's Braintree. Braintree supports Android, iOS, JavaScript clients. They have SDKs in .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby, everything you might want. It's a few lines of code with their V.0 SDK, literally 10 lines of in-app code. And they do the work to make sure it's secure, it's reliable, they pay you fast. It is great. They will take PayPal. They will take credit cards. They will take Venmo. They will take Bitcoin. They will take Apple Pay. And when new payments come along sometime down the road, they'll take those too. So, you know, this is why you don't want to write your own code for this. You get Braintree to do it. It is fabulous. BraintreePayments.com/security now. If you want, they'll do the integration for you even. But I don't think you're having any trouble. You could. It's a small snippet of code. 10 minutes later, you're done. And your users will be loving you. Find out more and get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free at BraintreePayments.com/security now. That's BraintreePayments.com/security now. We thank them for their support of the Security Now show. All right, time to buckle down here and find out why Steve will not use Windows 10 until Donald Trump is up for re-election.
Okay, so this, I'm sure this comes as no surprise, no huge surprise to our listeners. You know, like right now, the machine in front of me, I'm looking at 5 big screens and I'm running Windows XP. Because for me, an operating system is a tool. It's my working device. I mean, it's what I use to it's where I spend my day. So I sort of see this distinction as, you know, are these tools or toys? And Windows as an operating system, you know, I load applications into it. It provides the applications with a place to live. It allows me to manage my files and lets me run apps. I mean, that's what it is. It's not an end in itself. And Microsoft has done really nothing since Windows 98 to change that. You load apps and manage your files and you run applications. You know, that's it. But again, I recognize that's not everybody. I was running until a year and a half ago. GRC's website was Server 2000, Windows Server 2000, because it was fine. It ran for years, literally 3 years, I think, at one point without rebooting it because I had dialed it in. I had shut down everything unnecessary. It's wrapped in layers of additional security. So its own security wasn't a problem. But I started getting these really bad marks at SSL Labs because it didn't support the latest TLS protocols. And so I jumped to Windows Server 2008 R2 in order to step up and be able to support the latest protocols, which I acknowledge is important. But I'm happy that I got 14 years of use out of that operating system before I had to make the move. And I sort of feel the same way about my own operating system. That is, XP is not supported, of course. Still works fine. Firefox is being maintained. Chrome is being maintained. I've got Firefox in a sandbox, as I mentioned. I'm not downloading crazy apps all the time and running them. That isn't my mode. This is a working operating system for me. And nothing Microsoft has done since this has given me any reason to move, except it's now getting a little old. At some, 64 bits is becoming important. This is 32 bits. And so the 4 gig of memory, and of course, my Windows famously only really is able to use 3 out of that 4 due to architectural limitations. So I'm sort of thinking, hey, Chrome would be more feasible if I had a 16 gigabyte machine rather than 4, because it takes up a chunk of my memory when I start Chrome. I got into Windows 10 early and had it. I was set for the fast cycle update, and over the last couple of months, I was staying current with it and looking at it. And when it all settled down, I then spent some time. And I came away feeling very glad that Windows 7 is being supported through 2020. I expect that probably after I get SpinRite 6.1 launched will be a good time for me to finally move from XP to Windows 7. But I won't be going to Windows 10. Not because, I was going to say not because there's anything wrong with it. Except it.
Wait a minute. There is, obviously, right?
Yeah. It's that it doesn't offer me anything I want.
Right.
But you would
be happy with a command line operating system, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Let's be very clear here.
Yes.
The start menu does you no good.
No. In fact, it's in my way.
Yeah.
I look at that and I think, okay, you made it. You made the things I want to do harder for me to do.
Right.
It's less accessible. And what I want is not the OS to be an end in itself, but I just want it to give me access to my programs. And I don't see that Windows 10, and this is my point, they didn't write it for me.
You should have written your own, Steve. Come on.
Maybe somebody will skin it. Because I'd like to have, if there's better innards, then that would be a good thing. If they could skin it so that it didn't get in my way. It just, to me, poking around in there, it's just like, wow, I don't want to use this. Like I did turn on file extensions and looking at the browser, well, I get this ribbon full of, Sesame Street icons rather than menu options. And it's like, what? Okay. This is for Jenny. This is not for me.
This is for normal users.
Yes, I think you're right.
You're a developer.
I would agree.
And you primarily use it as a server, right?
Well, I use it as an operating system.
Oh, okay.
See, the operating system used to be something that ran applications.
Yeah.
Now it's a Disneyland fairy park with flipping tiles and stuff coming in and out. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It is kind of a Disneyland. You kind of have a good point there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the internet has happened and we're connected and I got very unnerved when it wanted me to log in with my Microsoft account.
Yes.
And it's like, ooh, wait a minute. I have a really secure password. Now it's disappeared and now I log in with my Microsoft account. And I removed that and went back and it worked okay. And then I thought, Steve, come on, you have to have the experience. So go ahead and do this. And of course, what that does is that's the glue that allows your different instances of Windows 10 to synchronize themselves in the cloud so that things like, you know, the new browser, the Edge browser, tabs and open pages and things follow you around. And when you, you know, when you go to a different machine and log in with yourself there, it sort of is able to, that stuff follows you thanks to its connectivity. So first of all, I completely get it that Windows 10 is not for me. I'm not the target audience. They lost me back when I had all I needed, which was just get out of my way and let me, you know, run apps quickly without having to navigate through. I mean, and I started to pull things down onto the tray so that I could get to them more easily. And I mean, so yeah, you know, if I had to use it, then maybe. But the good news is I've got 5 years before the OS that I will probably move to, which is Windows 7, in order to go 64 bits, and I'll probably, God knows how many gigabytes of RAM I'll load it with, because if I'm doing it, I'm doing it. And I'm sure I'll use Windows 7 well past its expiration date, just as I have used XP, probably very happily. And then, you know, who knows? That'll have given Windows 10 some seasoning time, and maybe, you know, they'll have skinned it. But okay, so we're dealing with an audience which is probably more sympathetic to that point of view, my point of view, than than the typical Microsoft customer. And Leo, you are probably more aware of this than I am. I do remember seeing that in the first 24 hours, Microsoft reported 14 million installs or downloads or whatever you would, however you would call it.
Yeah, upgrades. 67 million after 3 days.
Okay, and do we know where they are now? I mean, is it still just probably cranking along?
No, they're all in a toxic hell stew. a certain number of them may well have rolled back. You have 30 days to roll back to your previous version if you took advantage of the free upgrade. But I think most of us, and I'll include myself here, think this is a really nice version of Windows.
Right.
And I kind of agree with you. I don't care about the flipping tiles. But I also think you, if you weren't writing software for Windows, you would probably be using BSD.
Yes. Well, in fact, I heard you say on MacBreak Weekly that what you like about the Mac is that it's got BSD under it. And I've said here, once I am no longer developing Windows code, I'm Mac. That'll be a happy day for me.
But the good news is for those who are not, like Steve, developers of software for Windows, go ahead and use a Unix version. Don't install an X window manager. Just use... You can make it as plain and as simple as you want. And you know what? Unix is still the best operating system ever written, period. And this going along with what you're saying here. The whole point of Unix, and in fact, Alan Kay mentioned this, was to do as little as possible.
Right.
And if you want more, you add an app. But, you know.
Right. Well, and that actually follows from the original philosophy of C. C, the language, was a minimal, just a scaffolding of syntax, and it was all the libraries that you brought in that gave it the functions and made it a richer environment. So that's always been that approach.
C was designed for the purpose of writing Unix,
right?
Basically,
yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, it was, and Unix was rewritten from PDP 11 assembly language in C as its first task.
To your point, the less the operating system does, the easier it is to secure it.
I think that's correct. Now, what we have, what my take on Windows 10 is that this represents a sort of a philosophical change from, now maybe 8 already had this, and I never really looked at 8 closely because it was so clearly
it was horrible, the wrong
thing.
It was a horrific UI.
So we have a relationship with Microsoft with the new Windows, much like users of Apple ecosystem and Google ecosystem have, where there's a set of services which are now becoming desired. I mean, they're available. They are a function of the connectivity we have, the bandwidth that we have, the incredible amount of inexpensive cloud-based storage that we have, the crypto security technology, which everyone who does these things brings to bear, where it's now about being connected and being mobile and being multiple device and having things synchronizing among themselves. And of course, we know that one of Windows' claims to fame is that it is a single OS, which is multi-platform in terms of scaling platform. The same thing runs on your laptop. It's touch-enabled, and it can also run on a Windows phone if anyone ever buys one of those.
it's getting harder and harder.
all connected. So with that connectivity comes consequences on privacy. And, you know, we've spent lots of time talking about Apple privacy agreement and how they support, you know, can they actually not decrypt iMessage and those sorts of things. We've talked lots about Google privacy and what Google is doing and the, you know, the ways in which they're monetizing us. You know, we know that when we're using Gmail, Google is looking at the plain text of the mail and using that in order to produce email context aware ads. I mean, that's part of the deal with Gmail. Again, not knowing anything about 8, what I see as the big change, and this is a sea change from certainly from XP and even from everything I've seen of 7, because all my new machines are 7. I'm not in front of one now, but like, you know, Skype is running on Windows 7. I was playing with Media Center for a while on Win 7, and I've got, and you know, Windows 7 is what I would use now setting up any new machine. And I'm just in front of XP because I don't want to set up a new XP machine right now because that takes a lot of time to get it working. But so this to me represents Microsoft doing the same as Google has done and as Apple has done. That is wanting to play in this same ballpark, which means with that comes a whole bunch of features which have never been in Windows before at this level. That is like in the OS without any applications installed, just the operating system itself it's cloud aware, it's connectivity aware, it's you know, an account with Microsoft. We never had an account with Microsoft. I had a username and password on my operating system. Now Microsoft magically logs me in when I log into them, you know, into the cloud. So this is, to me, this is a huge change. I think it is future looking. I mean, this is I think what most people look for. It's like, oh, look, now I have in Windows, these sorts of things, you know, social networking and connectivity and all that. But with that, and so I don't think that's evil. I mean, I don't think any of this is evil. And in fact, what Microsoft has done has been to be very transparent. But the other thing they've done is enable it all. That is, and that's, if there's any controversy, it's that if you choose the Express install, and you don't have to, and my advice to anyone who's concerned is not to use Express install. So my number one recommendation when installing Windows 10 for your first time, and it's not like these settings can't be changed later, but don't use Express Install. Express Install doesn't ask you any questions and just turns everything on. I mean, with the exception of location services, and I was impressed that that was off by default. That's the one thing that isn't on. The rest is, and we'll run through that, like what the rest means here in a second.
And if you did Express settings, which I did because I wanted to get going as fast as you can, you can go back and step through these. I mean, it's
absolutely.
It's hard to find them all, but you can totally do that.
Yes, they're all there. And okay, so the one thing that so I think what Microsoft has also done is it's they're under privacy. There's 13 pages of settings. under privacy.
Okay.
Yep. But so what Microsoft has done, I would argue they may have leaped frog. Well, first of all, Microsoft is in a slightly different position than Google, although to the degree that our experience is now the browser and Chrome is Google's browser and Google has all these browser-based services, you know, people have already said, you know, the browser is the operating system. You know, I mean, it's like they're in the browser. You can now do whatever you want. You can do word processing. You can do spreadsheets. You can do, you know, social networking and mail and messaging and everything. So, what Microsoft has done is to integrate all of this stuff deeply into the OS, so that, for example, traditionally, when we've been talking about tracking, we've been talking about cookies or panopticlick style browser fingerprinting, or using the browser's cache in different ways, or e-tags. You know, that was sort of the focus was, okay, here's a user on this browser, and the things they do are, as they move around the internet, thanks to third-party content, which websites are putting in, sometimes for their own analytics, sometimes in order to offer ads or whatever, are identifying these people to different degrees. Microsoft has been absolutely upfront with the fact that they have something new called an advertising ID, which is uniquely assigned to each user on a device. And yep.
That's right there, the very first privacy setting.
Yep. The number one thing that you see is it explains that, you know, this is what it is and you can turn it off if you don't want that. And they also explain that there will be some features which no longer function if the advertising ID is turned off. Now, as is always the case, it's going to take us a while to deeply understand this new thing. So when they say that that ID can be used by third parties, such as app developers and advertising networks for profiling purposes, I'm not sure what that means. Again, I'm not using Windows 10, so no one's going to, you know, make me do this. But the reason I want to explain it is that, you know, from what we're being told, and again, Microsoft is upfront about it, this is a single ID, which to me seems very powerful. Apparently apps that you run can query for it, and advertising networks, and Microsoft's own advertising network, I know for sure, is able to use it. It does give a different ID for each user on the device, so that's sort of a good thing. There was always this concern about, well, what if multiple people use the same browser? Then, you know, you're not actually tracking individuals, you're tracking the browser, and that's not the same as the person. I guess if you are logging off and logging into different sessions on the same machine, then certainly then you would have per user browser experiences. And so then you get this. But, you know, Microsoft is clear. This is for each, this advertising ID is for each user on a device. Okay, so there's that. And you can turn it off. It is on by default if you use Express settings. The other concern is, again, part of what convenience and helping people not hurt themselves, I think. And that is that the BitLocker whole drive encryption recovery keys are backed up into your Microsoft OneDrive account.
Now, by the way, this is not available on Windows 10 Home.
Okay, so not on the home version.
Only in the Pro and Enterprise versions, is that true?
So BitLocker itself is not available?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, right. And so there have been, you know, people have written whole columns about how horrible this is that your whole drive encryption, is, you know, keys are being sent to Microsoft. I read one account that said, in the clear. And it's like, well, they have to be because they need to be usable. And presumably you forgot what the password was or lost your keys or something. So, yeah. But again, I think, you know, for what it is, BitLocker protects you if your laptop is stolen at the airport. And so that nobody else is able to access the contents of your local hard drive. It doesn't provide the same class of TNO protection that using a third-party whole drive encryption would, where you are 100% responsible and you better not lose your keys or, you know, you're completely out of luck. Here, Microsoft is saying, we're going to encrypt your drive and we're going to make sure you don't lose the contents of your drive by losing your keys. So we're going to back them up to OneDrive. I haven't dug into this to see whether that uniquely can be turned off. But that was one of the other things that I saw. And it's like, yeah, well, this is the sort of trade-off that to me makes sense. Now, there's been a bunch of confusion about Wi-Fi Sense. Really some over-the-top writing about this. And my complaint is only that you don't have to the individual granularity, because it turns out that what we first thought when this first appeared, it looked like it was enabled by default in a way such that people Skype, Outlook, and Facebook, your friends, you know, your contacts that you have there would automatically be connected to your network or any network that your computer knows about, you and your Microsoft account knows about, just when they approach that network. What people missed was that it needs to be enabled per network, and it is not enabled per network by default. So while Wi-Fi Sense itself, that is sort of the umbrella service, is enabled, and the sharing is enabled, you need to deliberately say, I want to share my home network or my work network or, you know, whatever, you know, network that my machine knows about. You need to explicitly enable that. Now, again, the problem we still have is that when you do that, you can't control to whom. It's all of your Facebook friends. It's all of your Skype contacts and so forth. And I'm hoping that we'll see that change. I imagine, you know, this is version one. And one of the appealing things about Windows 10 is that they're promising not to strand people like I am stranded right now on XP, unwilling to invest in completely setting up a brand new system from scratch. They're saying that, you know, maybe they'll stop calling it 10 after a few years because that'll just be, well, there's not going to be any 11 or 12 or 13. We're just going to roll features forward because we're no longer charging and making this a profit center. Well, it is a profit center in a different manner, probably. Not, you know, we're not charging people to upgrade from one operating system to the next. So might as well just give them features as they're ready in you know, rolling service packs, which, again, I think is an appealing idea because, you know, I wish they were doing that for for my operating system. But anyway, so for what it's worth, I'm hoping that what we'll see is the ability to select from your contacts the people who you wish to share your Wi-Fi password with, rather than it just being everyone on a given network or no one, because I think that would be a nice enhancement. So, okay, so number one recommendation for people who are interested in getting control or having control is if you install or when you install Windows 10, it don't use Express Settings, in which case you will be taken through all of the things that you can later look at separately. But this sort of, you know, for the purists among us, you know, there are people, for example, who put whole drive encryption on a blank drive before they start using it because they feel better never having written in plain text to that drive. It's always been encrypted. So when they blast the password off of their whole drive encryption volume, there's never been any sector relocated that had some plain text in it, for example. So for someone who wants to like start off with Windows 10 locked down the way they want it locked down, the secret is don't use Express Install. So under the way you, if you use Express Install or if you already got it installed, everything you need is either in the 13 different pages of privacy section under the settings menu or settings dialog, or in links that shoot off of that. So, as I mentioned, this first page, the so-called general privacy settings, allows you to completely disable the advertising ID. So it's on by default, presumably. And I wanted to get the experience most users have, so I deliberately did an Express install, and so I have not yet take Windows myself through the step-by-step non-Express. But I imagine one of the things that they ask you is, do you want to enable the advertising ID, which will be made available to other apps around the platform and advertising partners and Microsoft themselves? That you can turn off, and it will erase it from existence if you turn it off. Also, under Privacy General, there is one of the things that has sort of annoyed people is the option, the second option reads, send Microsoft info about how I write to help us improve typing and writing in the future. So this has been billed as, you know, keystroke logging.
It's a really weird setting. I don't even know what that means, to improve typing and writing in the future.
Yeah, I know. And in fact, it is some of these are worrisome. I mean, not that I want to be paranoid. It's just it would be nice to know what they were actually doing.
They haven't documented them very well.
Right. And so this is what I meant when I said it's going to take us time to learn this big new thing. You know, what exactly do they mean? Now, one of the things that they've done is this is Windows for the first time has Cortana, which is a system very much like Siri or, help me, Google, or maybe Alexa over on the Amazon side. You know, it's the assistant, which wants to be as prescient as it's able to, and it wants to do the best job it can. So much of what the scarier stuff of like that of the that we'll get to here in a second is arguably all of the sensors which Cortana is aggregating from, so that when you ask her to call somebody, you've given her access to your contacts, and maybe you were like already in, you were recently in contacts and looking at that person, and so
maybe
you've
that's
made
it.
Her,
but we don't know.
You've made her job a lot easier because we know that she can. She is watching what you do as you use Windows. And there's more detail about that in a minute. But the second setting, send Microsoft info. We don't know what info about how I write to help us improve typing and writing in the future. Yeah. Okay. Don't use semicolons enough. I don't know. So,
well, it could be an autocorrect thing. I mean, we're used to that with keyboards, for instance.
Yes. Yes.
SwiftKey does that, for instance, for predictions. But as far as I know, I don't see any predictions in Windows, unless they're talking about Edge. Maybe part of the problem with this could be specifically for Edge's autocomplete, but it doesn't say. And I wish it would say.
So,
by the way, I leave all this stuff on. So I'm the anti-Steve. I'm the opposite.
Yeah. And again, I'm not. First of all, like I said, no one's making me use this.
Right.
So mine is offer than off because I'm not getting near this thing.
I read that and I thought that is a strange sentence. And it, I could see why people would be a little nervous about that.
So let websites provide locally relevant content by accessing my language list. It's like, okay. So, browsers have a query header which tells them what the language is of the operating system. So maybe if you have more languages listed, let websites provide.
That's already happening with Google. When I was in Germany, Google decided that I should read things in German. So that's a feature a lot of browsers do. By the way, I think we figured out what that writing thing, at least one potential use, the touch keyboard, the on-screen keyboard, does do autocorrect. It does do predictions.
Ah, nice.
So in order to do that, Microsoft would, in fact, have to learn about what you're typing. It would also need to know where you are to appropriately recommend in the language you use. I mean, it could be as benign as that, but because they don't tell you, we don't know.
Well, okay. And again, yes. And all of these services, like Siri and Cortana and help me Google, they're all about the cloud. So once upon a time, autocorrect could have been done locally, but you'd have a dictionary and it could learn, but then that wouldn't necessarily automatically translate to you typing the same thing on your laptop. And so this is all, glued together through the cloud.
Incidentally, there is in the Microsoft EULA an explanation, thanks to CLT Steve in the chat room. Microsoft says, we collect your typed and handwritten words to improve character recognition and provide you with a personalized user dictionary and text completion suggestions. Some of this data is stored on your device. Some is sent to Microsoft to help improve these services. You can turn it off in the settings.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so again, I don't think any of this.
Not a keystroke logger.
No, exactly. No, well, it is.
It is, but it's not a nefarious.
But they're saying, look, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
And this is my point. There's nothing being hidden here. And I think, Microsoft has been the victim of like all kinds of lawsuits over the years. They know they want to do this. And so what they're saying is, okay, don't use Express Install, and we'll walk you through making these decisions. Do you want this or not? So what they're doing is completely open, nothing underhanded, and so that allows people to decide: do I want that feature or not? Am I creeped out by having Microsoft monitoring what I'm typing? It's like probably not. I think most people would rather have Microsoft fix their typos for them.
Yeah. At least they, I have to say, at least they they surface this.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And there's and here they're not bogging us down in details. I think that the license agreement is 12,000 words.
Yes, that's
I read somewhere.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, if you really want to know what these things mean, you'll have to sit down and read. But it's there. I mean, I'm sure Microsoft is telling us what they're doing. The fourth item there is manage my Microsoft advertising and other personalization info. This has gotten a lot of concern only because it takes you it's not local. It takes you to Microsoft to choice.microsoft.com/ in my case en-gb/opt-out. So
yours is engb.
Yeah,
it should be enus. You're in Great Britain. See, you turned that feature off, didn't you? That's why it wants to know where you are. It's going to spell everything with a U now. Don't you care?
I think I pulled this off of one of the...
Oh, British site. Okay.
Off the British
site. Mine says
yeah.
U.S.
Okay.
By the way, some of this is mandated by... We got bit by this. The Ad Bureau and a consent decree they had with the Federal Trade Commission. We got a certified email and some serious threats about our website because we didn't have the ad choices verbiage on there. And you've seen this around. And this is online advertising industry's attempt to self-regulate so that, heaven forfend, the government doesn't regulate us. And we actually, they threatened to turn us into the FTC if we didn't actually put the verbiage that they specified on our webpage. So we did. Even though we collect no tracking information about you at all. But that doesn't matter.
So on this page,
this is what that is. Because you see that logo with the green triangle? That's the Ad Choices logo.
Sort of the sideways pointing green triangle. So the first thing is personalize ads in this browser.
Yep.
You're able to say, no, I don't want those. And then personalize ads whenever I use my Microsoft account, and that all and they mentioned that also includes Windows, Windows Phone, Xbox, and other devices. However, I will say to people, if you turn this off, check back in a day because there have been reports for it not being sticky. That it sort of that people have reported that they've gone back and it's turned itself back on again. So again, and these were pre-release reviewers. So this may have been a bug that has since been fixed, but just a little tip for our interested users.
Just so you know, we do it here. See that? Privacy policy and ad choices.
Nice.
And they were going to report us to the FTC if we didn't have that right on the front page that tells you what...
Who is they? The advertising people?
Yeah, ironically, it's a group funded by Google and Yahoo and all the ad people. And it's because of an FTC, I'm convinced, it's probably the root of an FTC consent decree. No. We'll regulate. We'll self-regulate. But, you know, threatening letters. And believe me, if you go to our site compared to 100 other sites, we're not exactly swamping you with tracking material. Anyway, but you know what? I was glad to do it because we do want people to know. Just so you know, Digital Advertising Alliance's self-regulatory principles. And if you go to aboutads.info, you can read all about it. There you go.
So that's
and I think that's what Microsoft's doing. It's got an opt-out, the whole thing.
Yes. So that's the first tab.
We've only just begun.
Okay. I'm keeping my eye on the clock. But second one is location. The way these are organized is also nice. There's generally, on most of these things, where there are sort of like app-level granularity, they provide a global enable-disable and then a per-app setting so that you're able to, you know, and we've seen this on our mobile devices, for example, where we're able to specifically allow and disallow things. So for me, It defaults to on. So location services is globally for all users on the machine. But I was impressed that the individual apps were all off on mine. I hadn't turned any of them on. So I thought, okay, that's nice that, you know, I'm not quite sure why that's the case, but it was. It was the only area where there were like things Microsoft was denying itself preemptively. And it looks like yours is the same way.
Yeah, and I did express settings. So,
yeah, as did I.
They default, I guess, to off.
Yeah. So so that's one thing you've got to explicitly say, I want to turn on location
My
service.
My guess is it's per app. This is how most mobile devices do it, where when an app wants it, it asks you. And then if you say yes, it'll turn it on.
Right.
That'd be my guess. All of these are Microsoft apps, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, mine too, because I haven't put any third-party stuff in yet.
And Cortana, you can't turn it off. It's on, but you can't turn it off.
Yeah, we're going to know where you are, sucker.
It says, location history must be on for Cortana to work. You'd have to turn Cortana off.
I have to know where you are.
I can't help you, Leo, if I don't know exactly where you are.
Now, the next tab is camera, which defaults to on, and I had four apps, they're all defaulted to on, too.
Yeah.
You got a lot more than I do.
Yeah, probably because I've given them permission at some point, right?
I don't know what MSN food and drink is and why it needs to look at me or have the camera on.
Well, I don't know either. Let's find it. It is. Food and drink.
Oh, God. Yeah,
maybe it wants to take a picture of how fat I am or something. I don't know. That's interesting.
But what is that?
Oh, they have a whole bunch of hub apps that they created for Windows Phone, I think, initially. And then later.
What was that thing? It looked like a weird pizza puff kind of. Who knows?
Sure to be wholesome.
I had four things. I had App Connector, and App Connector shows up a lot, I didn't have a chance to figure out what the heck that is. Yeah. But it's, you know.
Turn that off. I'm sure that it'll ask me if it needs it ever again. Same thing with all of these. Oh, Steve's frozen. So while we're calling Steve back, I'll just take advantage of this moment to turn off the camera. Yeah. Twitter, you know, might say, do you want to put a picture of you? But I don't, especially on this computer, this Dell, is the camera's down here in the lower left of the screen. It's always a picture up my nose. So in fact, why don't I just turn the whole thing off? I bet if you turn the whole thing off, apps don't ask you. If you leave it on, then apps will ask you.
So a microphone is, of course, on, and everybody can listen to you. Then we get to speech, inking, and typing.
Wow.
And the interestingly labeled button is getting to know you.
Stop getting to know me.
And you can press, you could say no.
There's a button that says stop getting to know me.
It does. And so under getting to know you title, it says Windows and Cortana can get to know your voice and writing to make better suggestions for you.
That's a good one.
We'll collect info like contacts, recent calendar events, speech and handwriting patterns, and typing history.
Why not?
And yeah. And if you don't want them, Windows and Cortana, to get to know you, you can press that button and it will stop. Then there's manage cloud info, which has go to Bing and manage personal info for all your devices. So they make it easy for you to go and deal with that, sort of giving you an easy-to-find portal into whatever Microsoft has. If you want to know what this is, this speech, inking, and typing settings, there's a learn more about that. So you can do that. And a privacy statement. So this is sort of the we're watching you do stuff on your computer unless you tell us not to. And apparently there's a nice video that talks about, you know, shows you all the benefits of having Windows know you.
One point that one of our chatters made, which is a very good point, is these are all, like the food app, are universal apps. They're designed to work on mobile as well as on desktop, and on your phone as well as your tablet as well as your desktop. So these are kind of settings that are universal to Windows 10. Windows 10 now is Xbox, Windows Phone, tablets, desktops, laptops. So it makes sense that they're going to have a broader range of settings, some of which make more sense on mobile
Correct.
Location of my desktop is pretty much fixed.
Yeah. Right? Well, no, unless you get that lever that raises and lowers it.
Well, I can go up and down.
That's right.
It's not moving to Denver anytime soon.
So under account info, we have let apps access my name, picture, and other account info, defaults to on. And then there is a app level granularity. I didn't have any.
Me neither.
But it says choose the apps that can access your account info. So as you install apps, exactly as you say, Leo, where the app says, you know, would like permission to access your account info, your name, your picture, and other stuff, you'll probably say yes or no, and it'll that list will get populated. Unless you globally say, no, I don't want any of that for any apps, in which case it's globally disabled. So I like the fact that they've got this global permit and then per app, you know, granular management. I think that's the right thing to do this. And then management of contact information. Choose apps that can access contacts. I had the app connector again, mail and calendar. Makes sense that it could access my contacts. And the Windows Shell Experience, which, you know, is flippy tiles, I guess. Who knows? It wants to access my contacts, too, for some reason. Maybe so it could show me whose birthday is coming up. Calendar is the next tab. And so basically this controls whether apps are able to access your calendar, defaults to on, and then app connector is there again, and mail and calendar. Not surprisingly, need to access your calendar. So that provides that granularity. Messaging, let apps read or send messages, text or MMS, defaults to on. And once again, app level granularity over which ones you can do. And I had none, but I see you've got two there.
App connector. Oh, no. Wait a minute. You've gone on to a messaging.
On messaging. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't have any either.
Yep. Okay, you don't have any yet. So apparently apps have access to, and this is, again, exactly as you were saying, Leo, this is a perfect example of something that makes much more sense in a mobile environment than on a desktop.
Well, here's an example on Android and iOS. If you install WhatsApp, I presume on Windows Phone too, WhatsApp sends itself a message to verify your phone number. And in order to automate that process, it needs the permission to read incoming text messages. That's the kind of thing. So if I installed WhatsApp, I'm betting this suddenly would have a checkbox here.
Yep. Control over your radios is next. Some apps use radios like Bluetooth in your device to send and receive data. Sometimes apps need to turn these radios on and off to work their magic. This has been a sore point with a number of people who follow me in Twitter, and we've talked about how iOS always tends to turn Bluetooth back on, even, you know, whenever you upgrade.
Beacons, I'm sure. Yeah.
It's like, no, darn it.
Yeah.
So again, this defaults to on. You could globally turn it off or give individual apps permission to turn on and off your device's radio settings.
We should also be clear, when we say default, we mean if you choose Express Settings. We're looking at mine, which is Express Settings.
Same thing.
If you don't choose Express Settings, you're walked through each one of these settings, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And, you know, and get to decide what you want to do.
Which I think that's good. Personally, I leave all this stuff on. It doesn't bother me, but I think it's good they give you the choice.
Yes, I think, and again, Microsoft is being transparent and deep.
Yes.
Deep and transparent. Sync with devices is on the other devices tab, which is describes as let your apps automatically sync and share or share and sync info with wireless devices that don't explicitly pair with your PC. Yeah, with your PC, tablet, or phone. And the example they give is beacons.
Ah.
So, you know, something that's there that's like wants to ping you and you'd like beacon functionality. So it's like, yeah, okay, fine. And then again, app level granularity. Once there are some apps that can do that, you're able to enable, presumably permit them over time and then also manage them on this 13-page privacy settings dialogue. Finally, we get to, we're almost done, feedback and diagnostics, which is, this was weird too, feedback and diagnostics. So under feedback frequency is Windows should ask for my feedback, dot, dot, dot. And you, the default I had was automatically. That's what's recommended. But you can also say always. So I want Windows to always ask for my feedback?
No.
Like, or once a day, once a week, or never. And so maybe, Cortana, this reminds me of the little Cliffy Jiffy clip.
How you feeling? How you doing? Is it good? Are you liking it? What do you think? Yeah. What do you think?
Oh, my Lord. So I don't know what – I mean, I'm
saying that
to
never. I don't – yeah. But what's not clear is, does that mean that no feedback will be sent or it won't ask me?
Yeah, it's Windows should ask for my feedback, dot, dot, dot. And so you could say, I don't ever want Windows asking for my feedback. I mean, I don't know what it – I mean, I'm tempted to say always just so that I can
see – Well, let's see what happens. Yeah. All right. Then yeah. We'll at least get some idea of what it's asking for.
Yeah. Next tab is background apps. And so this is let apps run in the background. Microsoft explains choose which apps can receive information, send notifications, and stay up to date, even when you're not using them. Mm. Turning background apps off can help conserve power. Once again, this is more something a battery running user might be concerned about. But my list, they were all on by default, as are yours, Leo. Mine, and so the list is alarms and clock would make sense to have that running in the background, certainly. Well, I don't know why food and drink wants to run in the background.
It wants everything. It's very demanding, yeah.
Maybe it's worried about getting thirsty. Groove music,
yeah,
health fitness,
yeah.
Mail makes sense to run mail in the background. Maps, for tracking you or knowing where you're located. The browser, Microsoft Edge wants to run in the background. OneNote, people, there's a people app. I don't know what that does, but that wants to run in the background. The phone companion, that sounds good if you have a phone. Photos, store, weather, and Xbox, which I'm sure is the Xbox remoting streaming thing that you and Paul have talked about.
Right.
Last tab that is the last tab. Oh, but I had separate notes about Cortana because again, that's stirred up people, I think, needlessly. Again, in order for Cortana to work as well as Siri does, I mean, Siri is also looking at all your stuff in order to get context, in order to know, like when you say call somebody, she needs access to your contacts list and to look through the name in order to figure out who you're referring to. So
this is good because I'll tell you what. In the example, they say, when is the next Seahawks game? I don't ever want to know when the next Seahawks game is. So fortunately, she at least knows enough not to tell me there's a Seahawks game coming up. She would tell me when the Giants and the Niners games are coming up.
However, now that we've turned Ask Me Always, Windows may ask you how you liked the
Seahawks.
How
are you liking them? You like those uniforms?
Yeah. So, in some of the boilerplate I found, they've explained under Cortana, it says configure what you need. I think that's my advice, configure what you need. By default, Cortana has visibility into pretty much everything in order to improve performance.
Yeah, you want a long list of things? Look at the Cortana interface and what its notebook, what things it knows about me.
Yes.
Wow.
So location history, contacts, search history. Again, Cortana has your search history, calendar details, content, everything. And communication history for messages and apps, and any other information on your device.
Those are my packages are coming.
Basically, you're saying that I'm going to, in order to get this functionality in the watch everything I do version, just leave this all on. Microsoft explains that in Edge, their browser replacement of IE, Cortana collects and uses your browsing history. And that's, I was talking about search history before. So from the privacy agreement, Microsoft says, to enable Cortana to provide personalized experiences and relevant suggestions, Microsoft collects and uses various types of data. such as your device location, data from your calendar, the apps you use, data from your emails and text messages, whom you call, your contacts, and how often you interact with them on your device. Cortana also learns about you by collecting data about how you use your device and other Microsoft services, such as your music, alarm settings, whether the lock screen is on, what you view and purchase, your browser and Bing search history, and more. Meaning, you know, everything. Now, I have survived until now quite happily without any of this. And I'm going to continue to do so.
You're lost, Steve. That's all I'm saying. So, you're lost.
And the last thing I had in my notes was the issue of whether you choose to tie your local Windows account into your Microsoft account.
Right.
And so some of the device I've seen online suggests, and this is done by default. That is, you says, oh, you log into your Microsoft account. And I did, because I've been a developer for decades. And then when you log into your computer, suddenly it was asking for my Microsoft account login at my login screen rather than that the password right. and that I had just assigned to that right. machine, which was like, whoa, what? That again, you may wish to remove your Microsoft account from Windows 10 and use a local account instead. If you do, then you're not logging into Microsoft at the same time as you log into your machine. And so you lose the synchronization features which you would otherwise have. But under settings accounts, we just went through settings privacy and all the subtabs. Under settings accounts, you have complete control over this. You can easily go back and forth to experiment with it. So again, it's not like you're locked in forever. You get to choose. So, that's it. As I said, I think this is it's deep penetration into what you and like essentially your entire experience of using Windows, but it is also transparent. Microsoft, you know, wants the depth to provide you services, to provide the set of features that are now becoming expected in, you know, the sort of things you get when you're in the Googleverse or when you're in, you know, in the Apple ecosystem. This is now, you know, put into the base OS platform, and the user has control of it. I'm just going to stay with Windows 7, as far away from this as I can.
But like I said, if you had your druthers, you'd just have a command line, a little C prompt, and a blinking cursor.
In fact, I heard someone tell you, I think it was maybe one of your Mac guys, that maybe it was somebody on, I don't remember where, but that they launch apps just by clicking in the search and typing the first few characters.
I do too.
And that's better than browsing through a big growing tree of
you can do that on Mac and Windows.
Yeah.
Which is nice. You just type the first few letters and hit return and boom.
Yeah, I have a simple first layer of my start menu. You know, a start button, and then there's everything right above it that I typically use. And for the things I use less, I have a nice hierarchy I drill down into. And so, you know.
Well, you're going to like Windows 7 in about 5 years when Donald Trump leaves office, because it has that feature built in. All you have to do, and Windows 8 and 9, 10, 11,
oh, in
12.
Fact, you have to have a keyboard with a Windows key, though, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, you hit the Windows key and you start typing W-O-R-D, and then you hit return and you got WordPad.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So there we have it. We needed to do a podcast to talk about this because, you know, privacy is of big interest to our listeners. And I would just say when you're setting up Windows 10, if you know, now you know what's there, don't use Express Settings. Walk yourself through this and tune this the way you want. Or just say no to Windows 10. And you could use Windows 7 until 2020 with me.
Join the Unabomber in his cabin. Well, that's why this show is so great. We've got you and we got me. And between the two of us somewhere, you know, you could take your pick. Steve always, because see, I never saw technology I didn't like and turn on and say yes to. And I always want to use the newest, latest version of everything.
Yeah, and I just sort of seems unnecessary to me. It's like, I mean, I can't, when I build this new machine, it's going to scream on Windows 7.
It is.
Because there won't be any of this nonsense tiles flipping around.
Yeah. Steve you can find him at his lovely modern website, grc.com. Minimal JavaScript, right, Steve?
None.
Zero. None. Don't even worry. No trackers, nothing. You can examine it with Ghostery till the cows come home. You'll never find anything on there. But you will find SpinRite, the world's best hard drive and maintenance utility. You will find lots of free stuff, including Squirrel and PayPerfect paper passwords and all sorts of great stuff. You will find this show, 16 kilobit audio, too. No one else has that. As well as the transcripts from Elaine. No one else has that. The full show notes and all of the stuff you need at grc.com. So maybe questions next week.
Yes. Well, that's post Black Hat.
Oh, maybe not.
So,
no questions. But hold your questions. If you have a question, grc.com/feedback is the feedback form. You can also tweet Steve. He's at SGGRC. And he definitely is now engaged in the Twitter. We're going to get him on the Facebook, and he's going to be soaring with the Eagles.
Facebook and Windows 10 go together.
I think you're probably not going to use either of those. Yeah, yeah. We have audio and video of the show at our site, twit.tv/SN. Can't promise you a JavaScript-free environment, however. You can also use your favorite podcatcher. You know, this show is everywhere. You can even dial, 407? You can phone us.
Don't bother.
You can also watch live if you want. We do the show every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 East. I'm sorry, Tuesday, 1:30 East Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC on twit.tv. We'd love it when you're in live. And I've been interacting with the chat room, and we've been having fun, too. Thank you, Steve.
I will see you on Saturday for the new screensaver.
Oh, yes. Tune in, everybody. That'll
be our first post Black Hat and DEF CON confab. And then I have no doubt there were some really interesting, spooky, scary things that are teasers in the Black Hat program. And it's funny too, because I was on Twiet with Father Robert and Mark Smith and a couple others. And, you know, they were saying that, you know, they love to go. And I said, the problem with going is that all the good things are happening at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually saw people tweeting, like, in fact, it was Matthew Green is there, our Johns Hopkins cryptographer. And he tweeted that four different topics, all of which he wanted to see, were at the same time. So I rest my case. You know, I can do a better job staying here, getting work done, and then, you know, sweeping up the debris after we see what these things actually are.
Actually, Robert agrees with you. He says he just goes for the social. He doesn't even attend any of the tracks. He sits in the lobby, talks to people, because everything's on video at Black Hat anyway. Everything's on video after. Or is it DEF CON? At DEF CON, everything's on video after the fact, so you can always... you're not going to miss anything. You can always watch it later.
Right.
Steve, thank you so much. We'll see you next week. Actually, we'll see you Saturday for the new
Saturday, then next week for our post-DEF CON Black Hat. Then we'll probably do a whole bunch of Q&As in order to catch up with those, because we haven't been doing enough.
I'm sure there are a few.
Thanks, Leo.
Thanks, Steve. Security Now.